I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome back to Radio Times. Josh King had some advice for Donald Trump in Time magazine before the Republican National Convention about how to make the event a success, including making a grand entrance and making amends. Josh King worked as an advance man and was a White House aide for Bill Clinton. He's also the founder of the website Polyoptics, co-created a pilot for the West Wing. And he wrote a book. It's a new book called Off Script. It's about stagecraft, campaign spectacle, and political suicide. That's from the subtitle. And Josh King, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you, Marty.
You say that Donald Trump blew his entrance on Monday when he introduced his wife. What did he get wrong?
Well, he did a couple things really right, Marty. There was this moment when he was seen by the head-on camera in stark white silhouette. I think he realizes all the angles that he's often been photographed in over the last year, and you can really tell the sort of looming silhouette of Donald Trump when he's seen, and that was this intense backlight moment that he walked out. But interestingly, Marty, what happened next was that he made very brief remarks introducing his wife, Melania, and she came in from stage right, and there was a very brief exchange, and then he left the stage. Now, in my experience working at conventions, this goes all the way back to 1988, you have to understand that there are probably 120 feet away, maybe 200 still photographers who have been paid by their news organizations to capture that one stunning moment of that is going to be most newsworthy for the Philadelphia Inquirer and other newspapers around the world, which will show the most newsworthy moment. This would be the presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump and his wife Melania, maybe both faces aiming toward the banks of photographers, lingering for maybe 20 seconds or so that everyone can get the perfect shot. They seemed to be like ships passing in the night. Huh. You could tell that the top of the fold in the New York Times the next day was Trump back to the camera, Melania walking forward, and you couldn't make that two-shot that you really wanted to show husband and wife introducing the presumptive first lady to the nation. This was very similar, Marty, to what happened on Saturday when Mr. Trump introduced Governor Pence. Again, not nearly enough time to let photographers do their work. The problems with Mrs. Trump's speech aside, that single image that you wanted to capture for Monday night seemed to be lost because there wasn't enough time given to this key moment.
You're not suggesting that he should have done what Al Gore did, which was to give his wife a really big kiss on the lips?
Well, that would have been the opposite extreme, Marty. And I was there in 2000, the Staples Center in Los Angeles. And you remember sort of the context of that time, too. It was coming off of 2 years of obsession with the Lewinsky scandal and the state of the Clintons' marriage. I think Vice President Gore wanted to show at the time that his relationship with his wife Tipper was stable and strong, but it lingered a little bit too long with that wet kiss with all the photographers looming over him. Something more in the middle of the range, Marty, would have been more appropriate.
Interestingly, though, 13 months ago, when Donald Trump made his announcement, he came down the escalator at Trump Tower. Some folks thought that was sort of weird, but very, I think, Trumpian. How would you rate that as political theater?
Well, at the time, I thought it was weird, but I've since said that far be it for me to second-guess the tactical and strategic stagecraft elements of a guy who'd never served a day in elective office, declared his candidacy for president back on June 15th, I think it was, 2015, by coming down that escalator to a small crowd, some of whom were incented to be there at Trump Tower, and declared that he would be a candidate. No one who has watched politics for a long time might have given Trump the credit that he would eventually beat 16 other candidates, and yet he did. So I think it was interesting, Marty, a few days prior, Hillary Clinton had done her major announcement in front of a very large crowd out on Roosevelt Island, but Trump seemed to actually trump the opportunity when he came down the escalator. So that has become very much the Trump brand. Cruising down an escalator for 30 seconds does give those photographers, as we were talking about earlier, that opportunity to get the shot that they wanted to from the grand entrance. I wrote this piece for Time suggesting maybe that you would use a Deus Ex Machina like they did in the opera Nixon in China and actually bring a piece of the fuselage of Trump's 757 onto the stage. But that entrance that he used Monday night with the glorious white backdrop was about as dramatic as I can remember. It might go back to 2000 when outgoing President Bill Clinton did a long walk through the bowels of the Staples Center, captured on camera for about 90 seconds before he came on stage. It was very powerful.
Would it be fair to say that Donald Trump has broken the rules of stagecraft, I think the rules of campaigning and other rules as well, in order and clearly getting this nomination?
Just about every one of them, Marty. You know, and sometimes the rules aren't set by you, the candidate. If you think about the sort of unofficial traditional rules of Sunday morning network news shows are that the title of one of them is actually called Meet the Press. You actually go in and sit in a studio and look reporters in the eye, and the late Tim Russert would ask the toughest questions possible and sometimes get his guests to squirm in their chair. But for so many months, Marty, Donald Trump, because his very presence on a show, whether on the phone or in person, drove the ratings for that program, could dictate the terms. He could say, I might be in Trump Tower, I might be at Mar-a-Lago, I might be anywhere I want to be, but if you want me on your show, I'm going to call in rather than appearing in studio.
Yeah.
And the advantages that you have when you call in are you can sit with all of your talking points on your lap. You don't need to obsess over hair and makeup. And what the control room in these shows will do is they will use what we know as B-roll, these flattering images of the candidate at rallies or graphical images of how the candidate is doing in his latest polling numbers, or just a flattering still photo of the person on the phone. And for Trump, that worked extraordinarily well in these key months, let's call them September, October, November, December last year, leading up to the Iowa caucus, so that he didn't have to travel around. He could so effectively go from show to show to show just using the telephone, like we are now.
Like we are now, and who knows what we look like or what we're wearing, right?
Right, exactly.
But I'm thinking also, just leading up to this convention, the ability that he had to get cameras at almost any rally that he held, and those moments when he would throw a protester out, you could almost sense people salivating, waiting for that moment when he would fight with a protester. You say in this piece, it's time to make amends. I'm not sure that's going to happen or not. But in terms of stagecraft, he seemed to know how to pull that off.
Yeah, it was very strategic and wise on his part. I mean, think about it, Marty. He was the star of a highly rated network show, The Apprentice, for 15 seasons. Already with an enormous awareness level of who he was. And in a lot of these Republican and primary caucus states that he won, had a great fan base, amplified by the 8.5 million or so followers that he has on Twitter. And he didn't necessarily always go to the media markets where the next votes were going to be cast, Marty. He might pick a spot like Lowell, Massachusetts, or Birmingham, Alabama, where, frankly, they don't get a lot of celebrity appearances. And if he takes that 757 down to Birmingham, uses his Twitter feed to announce his attendance, makes it feel like the whole world is going to be watching Birmingham that Friday night when he came to Ladd Peebles Stadium, and then walks out in front of 35,000 people. Well, Birmingham and Alabama itself is not all that important from an electoral standpoint or whatever delegates the Alabama primary was going to deliver to him. But in terms of his ability to command and attract a crowd of 35,000 people at a time where his closest opponent their best crowd might number in the high hundreds, it was staggering for him.
You also, this is advice, unsolicited, I should say, unsolicited advice to Donald Trump. And I guess this is true with whoever the Democrat will be, probably Hillary Clinton, is that when the conventions are over, you can't go home, you can't take a vacation, you can't disappear. You have to stay relevant. You have to stay visible in August and, I guess, to Election Day in November.
That's certainly been the traditional rule, Marty. I mean, I can go back to where one of my earliest conventions, 1992, New York, Bill Clinton taps a similarly aged vice presidential candidate, Al Gore, as his running mate. They have a very successful convention. You remember this is when they first used the Fleetwood Mac song, Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow. And the foursome of Bill and Hillary Clinton and Al and Tipper Gore, this new sort of combination of a presidential candidate and his running mate and their spouses. What they did next, right after New York, was to get in a cavalcade of about 15 buses and go on a 6-day, 9-state tour that wended through New Jersey, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Ohio, Kentucky, all the way to St. Louis, Missouri, so that for 6 days after the convention, all of the key states that would be crucial to Clinton's electoral victory got a firsthand glimpse of the excitement that was generated in New York. Contrast this with what some candidates have done, like Mike Dukakis 4 years earlier, basically goes home to the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, takes some time off in the Berkshires, and returns to being governor. In these crucial summer weeks when you want to build on the momentum of your convention and sustain that momentum toward the fall, we're going to have an important event in the world starting August 1st. That's the 17 nights of the Olympic Games in Rio. Ah. And it's going to be crucial for these candidates to keep the momentum from their conventions alive, so that the natural instinct of Donald Trump and Mike Pence might be to go their separate ways or to come back to New York and resume the way that he managed his campaign leading up to the convention. If he's successful in that, that again would defy the rules that have established, like, you need to get out there and show that you have created this new partnership with Governor Pence
and
Josh, with Hillary Clinton and her running mate.
Yeah, and Josh, they're playing We Are the Champions by Queen. Queen did not authorize the use of this song for Trump's campaign. And interestingly, you know, a gay man singing a song, a very anti-gay platform. We're almost out of time here. In terms of stagecraft, how does this work for you?
Well, you know, the protests of the surviving members of Queen might come up at one point, but that'll be forgotten. And clearly, even the music that he used when he walked out was forgotten. He has legal rights to use this song, properly compensating them to the musical union. But you do want to respect the rights of the artists. And there's a long litany of artists who have brought litigation against politicians who've use their songs without permission, but it is murky legal and political waters to do so.
Josh King, thanks for joining us at AM Radio Times.
Thanks so much, Marty.
Your book, his book, as I should say, is called Off Script. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter with a specialty in business regulation, property, and tax law. He began covering Donald Trump decades ago when he was a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's now a columnist with the Daily Beast. He also teaches at Syracuse University College Law School, and he's got an upcoming book called The Making of Donald Trump. And David K. Johnston, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Well, nice again. It's been, I guess, over the years, almost a quarter century I've been on your show.
Indeed, and we're happy to have you back. And the last time we talked to you was a couple of months ago, or maybe even back in 2015. And I asked you about this guy named Donald Trump, and you had some really interesting observations that you've learned over the years. The country's gotten to know him in the last 13 months. Is the public Donald Trump the one that you would recognize?
No, not at all. And my book, which comes out August 2nd, so 13 days from now,
okay,
is just full of things people do not know about him, which I don't want to go into because I want people to get the book.
But, give us a little.
But, well, I go into Donald's writings and speeches that other journalists have not paid attention to show that his actual conduct is at a total variance with his positions about that he takes publicly on a number of issues. And you know, Donald's already called me. He called me in April. He had my home number for years to tell me that, you know, if he doesn't like what I write, he's going to sue me.
Join the club, right?
Yes, that's right. And I'll tell you, one of my children reminded me this morning, my eight grown children, some are Republicans, some are Democrats, but they all seem united, always loving to remind Dad that in their view, that at least they kid me, the reason that John Kerry did not win the 2004 election was that he announced he was taking a weekend off campaigning to read my book, Perfectly Legal, about our tax system. And so they always say, yeah, well, if he'd spent the 3 days campaigning, he'd probably have won the election because he didn't need that many more votes.
It's all your fault.
it's a way to have fun with the old man.
Indeed. Well, let me ask you some basic questions, because you have covered, as I said, Donald Trump since his days in Atlantic City, the early days of Atlantic City. Is he a good businessman?
No. And in fact, Fortune magazine did an analysis of the 496 companies some years ago using metrics they use every year. And Donald Trump came out in his casino business either dead last or right almost at the bottom in every single category: management, talent, allocation of assets, profitability, employee turnover, all the metrics that they use. When I arrived in Atlantic City, I left the L.A. Times to go there for the Philadelphia Inquirer because I believed casino gambling was going to spread across the country, and I wrote a book you had me on about,
yep,
Temples of Chance, that,
yep,
accurately predicted that. One of the very first things I started to hear from other casino operators was Trump doesn't know anything about running a casino. And he didn't. Business management tells us that when an industry gets in trouble, as Atlantic City has, losing its monopoly on East Coast gambling, the businesses that fail first are the ones that are badly run. Well, Donald was not the very first one to go out of business, but he was in the early wave here. Trump Plaza, his first casino, which has the best spot on the boardwalk, is now boarded up. It was sold for pennies on the dollar compared to what it cost to build. And Donald had a history of firing competent, first-rate executives and replacing them with yes men.
He also borrowed money. I mean, I'm not a business person by any stretch of the imagination, but I mean, I know that's what businesses do. They borrow, they leverage themselves, and with the thought that and belief, I guess, that they would pay themselves back. Did he do that more bigger than others?
He did not do it the way businesses are supposed to do it. Okay, you borrow money strategically. You borrow it when it's smarter to use that to grow the business than some other alternative. Donald, first of all, never had a dollar invested in Atlantic City. In his first deal, he got a fee off the top. In his second deal, he bought from Hilton the Trump Castle. He borrowed 100% of the money and took a $5 million fee off the top. And in the Trump Taj Mahal, same thing. He borrowed all the money and took a fee off the top. So Donald never had any skin in the game in Atlantic City. And he sucked out of the place before the 1990 collapse, where the headline we ran 2 days in a row, headlines above the masthead in the Philadelphia Inquirer, and the lead on one of them was, "You are probably worth more than Donald Trump."
Wow.
He starved the businesses for money. He pursued reckless policies. And, you know, other people, Harrah's, Borgata, they're still profitably operating in Atlantic City because they had quality management that understood the business. Donald just looked at Atlantic City as a gold mine to which he would just sluice out every dollar he could, including when he didn't pay workers, when he didn't pay all those vendors on the Taj Mahal. So, no, he was by no standard a good businessman. And secondarily to that, Marty, how many actual billionaires do you know who are out there hawking to you at every opportunity neckties, steaks, board games? It's not suggestive that this is a man who actually has great wealth. He just has great cash flow.
Well, that's interesting, because another question I had for you, and only I think Donald Trump knows the answer to this, but you've looked at his taxes from what you've been able to glean and looking at his business practices. is Donald Trump a billionaire?
Well, what I've said is my analysis of the public documents is that he's worth no more than $1 billion. That would be the most he's worth. A year ago, when he announced he was running, and I was, I believe, the only national journalist who said he's serious this time, unlike 1985, 1988, 2000, and 2012. I think he's serious this time, and he might get the nomination. And I was alone in saying that in June of last year. He announced within a matter of days that his net worth was $8.7 billion, $10 billion, more than $10 billion, $11 billion. Did you notice any huge, wild variations going on in the economy that would explain that sort of a change in a matter of days? I sure didn't.
So he can't. So
he makes it up. I mean, the short answer is he just makes stuff up. He's done this his whole life. He just makes stuff up.
So is the you and I talked about this. I remember this last year. How much do you, though, fault the press? And, of course, that includes a lot of different people and a lot of different ways that people get their news, for not understanding this man in terms of his business practices. And I realize as business journalists, I mean, they have areas of expertise. They know things that I certainly do not know. Where do you think the press fell down?
I've been very, very critical of my peers in the national press. We're supposed to vet candidates and scrub them. And while I'm sure there are listeners saying nobody vetted Obama, or Obama was thoroughly scrubbed, you can read a massive public record about his background. Donald Trump has not been well scrubbed. The Washington Post has done the best job, and I helped them with some of their stories and gave them documents from his enormous trove of Trump documents. But overall, the coverage of him has not gotten anywhere near where it should. There are two problems with covering Trump. The first one is that Donald has mastered the conventions of journalism better than anyone I know. And I have enormous admiration for his skill at this, and unhappiness that my fellow journalists don't recognize how much they're being manipulated here by him and how brilliantly. The second, though, is it's cheap and easy to cover what politicians say. I don't mostly care what they say. I care what they do. It's more costly and expensive, and you have to know how things work. And one of the most shocking things in my career I noticed was that one of the most famous, well-known editors in America, somebody who, at least among journalists, is very well-known, he did not understand how the grand jury process worked.
Oh, wow. Well.
And I was like, how can you get to be a masthead editor at a major newspaper and not know this? And I think the coverage of Trump has been very severely lacking, especially in understanding his business practices. And there's a rich public record. I mean, at one point I was renting two storage lockers to keep all my documents, many of which were on Trump.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's David K. Johnston. He's an investigative journalist, a columnist with the Daily Beast. He teaches at Syracuse University College Law School. He's got a book coming out in early August called The Making of Donald Trump. And as I said in my introduction, he has been covering Donald Trump for many years, including as far as his times at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. David, there's a lot of speculation about why Donald Trump will not release his tax returns. You've done a fair amount of digging into his taxes, or certainly what his income is and what it isn't. Why do you think he doesn't want to release them?
Well, first of all, there's a special rule Congress put in place for full-time real estate professionals, which Donald fits. And if Donald's buildings are worth anywhere near what he says, he doesn't pay income taxes. The vast majority of Americans are not allowed to take losses against their wages or other income from real estate. If you make over $150,000 a year, you're out. If you're on the alternative minimum tax, you're out. But if you're a full-time real estate professional, which Congress defines as 2 days a week, by the way, you can live income tax-free. And so that's one. Secondly, there are indications of fraud in Donald Trump's tax returns from a case I wrote about in the Daily Beast where he appealed 1984 audits by the state of New York and the city of New York. And his own tax guy testified when shown the photocopy of the tax return, the only copy anybody could find. No one could find the original, only the photocopy. He said, that's my signature, but I didn't prepare this tax return, which showed zero income from business and $600,000 of expenses. Mm. My first National Investigative Reporting Award was for exposing a crooked Michigan politician who put his name on somebody else's medical records with a photocopier, and as a result was made a lawyer by motion of the state Supreme Court, and then used it to cheat the person whose medical records he used out of her money. And it is never been explained what went on here, but that certainly is an indicator there may be fraud in his tax returns.
Interesting. You wrote something recently in the Daily Beast, the tax speech that could elect President Donald Trump. You wrote this for him. I'll just read a line or two. You have him saying, and this would be, of course, something he won't deliver, but if he did, he would say many, many rich people in America don't pay income taxes. They don't, or they pay almost nothing, almost nothing. It's true. Now, some rich people pay lots of taxes. They're losers, rich losers like Mark Cuban and Martha Stewart, but many rich people don't pay income taxes. And you're saying, you know, in a fictional world, that if he were to admit that, which you say is the truth.
Right. I think he could turn Marty into a positive by getting up and this is a well-documented fact. I mean, I've written about this at length. It's no secret among people who know tax that many of the wealthiest people in America live tax-free or virtually tax-free. And if Donald were to say, look, I'm going to tell you the truth about this. I've been paying taxes for decades, you know, starting in 1978 when my income went negative as far as the IRS is concerned and Congress is concerned. And we need to change that. You know, you should be paying less and people like me should be paying more. I actually think he could ride that to the White House.
Because it's the truth.
He won't do it. He's not going to do it. Donald is not a serious person who thinks through things like that.
You have a piece also in the Daily Beast. This goes, last week I'm reading the headline here, Donald Trump and kids named in a $250 million tax scam. Is there a simple description, because it's a complicated case, of what's at stake here?
Well, first of all, I want to disallow the headline. Writers don't write headlines. They are named, but they are not defendants at this point. They may become. They are material witnesses. A lawsuit filed under seal was unsealed by a state court judge. It involves a convicted violent felon, a guy who took the stem of a margarita glass and shoved it into a man's face once, who was a senior advisor to Trump and who traveled with Trump all over America, who Trump's children were with in Moscow, and who ran a $40 million stock fraud, stock swindle. And his punishment for all of this was a $25,000 fine and probation. He didn't get jail time. He didn't have to give the money back. And Donald has been photographed with him repeatedly. He is being sued in what's called a QTAM case. That's a private citizen acting as the attorney general. Huh. The New York State Attorney General declined to intervene in the case, so the private case proceeds. And in that case, he's accused of using four Trump deals that he worked on. And this is a guy who at one time had a desk right in the Trump Organization office to cheat the taxpayers. New York State, altogether, it's about $250 million of money that the lawsuit alleges was not taxed. Now, we don't know what's going to happen to this lawsuit at the end of the day, but it involves Trump properties, Trump deals, Trump licensing. This guy was involved with Trump in these deals. Trump got tens of millions of dollars, as did two of his children, in fees and partnership interests in these deals. And just imagine if in 2008 someone had said Barack Obama, material witness in $250 million alleged tax fraud. What if somebody said that tomorrow about Hillary Clinton, or had said it about George W. Bush? And nobody has picked up on this story. Mm. Nobody's touched it. And part of the reason is threats of litigation by Donald and by this stock swindler against anybody who starts to take a look at this stuff.
Interesting, in Cleveland, the Republicans there basically saying that Hillary Clinton is a crook. Chris Christie got them chanting that, basically, that she should be in prison. I'm reluctant to ask you this, David, but is Donald Trump a crook?
I don't want to make a conclusionary statement about that. I know Donald. That's why I'm writing about Donald. I don't know Hillary Clinton. I only wrote about her twice in my life, and she was furious. She went absolutely crazy over what I wrote about her. Not because it wasn't true, but because she didn't want it published. Same issue with Donald about a lot of what I write. Donald has spent his entire life gratuitously being involved with con artists, swindlers, mob associates, mobsters. His father's business partner was a mob guy identified in law enforcement reports. He has gone out of his way to do favors for a major, big-time cocaine trafficker who he continued to do business with after his conviction. And I think he does these things because he's made money off of them. They're profitable to him. And in one case, we don't know why he did the association with him. I've written in a number of columns that what we do know is that the record shows that Donald desperately needed this drug dealer to be his friend and not his enemy. But why he needed that, that's not clear.
I'm just sitting here on the radio nodding my head, David, just digesting all that you've told us.
And there are a whole bunch of civil fraud suits against Donald. The Trump University files, which I've collected, and the testimony in them, and what happened in Texas, where we have public record, what happened in Florida, are astonishing. Donald Trump's foundation made a gift to the Attorney General of Florida for reelection. It is against the law for a charity to give money in a partisan political campaign, and he did so right at a time when the Attorney General of Florida was considering whether to investigate him for fraud in the Trump University matter. And the campaign publicly said, there's a news clip of this, we're perfectly comfortable with the donation we received from the Donald J. Trump Foundation. It's like, where is the IRS? They're the tax police. Oh, that's right. We've cut the budget of the IRS so much that they don't have a budget to really enforce the law anymore.
David, I got to jump in here only because we got to end our discussion. Yep. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times. David K. Johnston.
Thank you, Marty.
Upcoming book, The Making of Donald Trump. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Just said goodbye to David K. Johnston, and now we say hello to Eugene Kiley. The Republican National Convention has kept fact-checkers busy this week. And we asked Eugene Kiley, director of factcheck.org, about the challenges of fact-checking all the claims made at the Republican National Convention and made by its nominee for the White House. We will be doing the same next week, fact-checking the DNC here in Philadelphia. And Eugene Kiley, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Well, thanks for having me, Marty.
What's the challenge of fact-checking a convention?
Well, the challenge is the time. These are primetime speeches, and they're getting pushed back further and further. So what starts at 9 doesn't end until 11:30, and that's when our night really begins. We're starting to identify things as the night goes on, but in terms of the writing and researching, the bulk of that isn't done until after midnight.
Well, let's start with Monday night. This was the theme of that night was Make America Safe Again. What were some of the claims that jumped out at you?
Well, as both parties try to do with these conventions, they have a message, a narrative to tell about the other party's nominee. And in this case, they were making the case that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have America is no longer safe under Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, both abroad and here in the United States. So Benghazi, crime, these kinds of things came up. For example, there was a very lengthy discussion about Benghazi on the night of September 11th, 2012, by two security contractors who were assigned to the CIA annex. And they told their story about how they were told by the CIA annex base chief to stand down and not to help the Americans who were under attack in the nearby temporary diplomatic facility. That's a story that they wrote in their book, 13 Hours. That's a story that was in the movie, 13 Hours. But that's not the story that's told in multiple government reports that said there was no such order was ever issued.
Another thing that was said, and then we'll talk about last night, neighborhoods have become more violent under President Obama. And certainly the shootings in the last couple of weeks has gotten a lot of people on edge and feeling as if we live in a very violent country. But how has the crime rate changed under President Obama?
Well, it's actually gone down from the numbers that we have, and it's limited because it goes up to or through 2014. So we don't have numbers for – well, we do have numbers for 2015 as well from a different source. But from the FBI, we only have from 2014. So the numbers are going down and have gone down, particularly from the 90s when it was at a peak. But even under Barack Obama, the numbers have gone down. Of course, there are cities that are seeing spikes in violent crime, and there are cities that are still seeing declines in violent crime. So, you know, you can point to any one of these cities and make your case, whether you want to make it the case that it's going down or up. But these short-term trends just don't tell the story yet. They're going to people that we speak to who are experts in this say you really need a longer body of data in order to draw any conclusions.
Is that the challenge of being a fact checker, which is especially fact checking a convention where you've got party insiders and outsiders and supporters and they want to get behind their candidate? And if the facts don't exactly line up, do they actually want to hear that?
Usually not. No, not the partisan types. Well, we hear a lot from them on nights like these. You know, and like in this case with violent crime, you can take these numbers and spin them however which way you want. So you can selectively cherry pick the data. So when we're presenting it, we might not make either side comfortable because what we're saying is that violent crime is down long term. Short term, we're seeing some increases in some areas, but it's too early to tell whether this is a trend. That doesn't make either side happy.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Eugene Kiley. He's director of factcheck.org, and his organization has been checking the RNC this week about the various statements made at the convention, at the various speeches at night. And as I said, we'll be doing the same for the Democrats next week. And if you want to join the conversation, any questions or comments you might have for our guest, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Anything that jumped out at you from last night's convention, day two?
Well, it was more of the same in the sense that, you know, what we saw was some outright falsehoods. Most of the speakers were telling half the story. And again, that's the half of the story that fits their narrative about Hillary Clinton. For example, Donald Trump Jr. talking about Clinton's gun control proposals. He claimed at one point that she wants or she says she's going to use an executive order to take Americans' guns away. Well,
did you ever say that?
Well, no. You can't take guns away with an executive order. That would be an overreach. What she has said in her gun proposal says is that she's looking for legislation to get through that would reinstate the ban that was on the semi-automatic assault weapons, the certain weapons, that expired back in 2004. She does want to tighten the background checks that are made at these point of sale. So, there are certain things that she wants to do through legislation that would make it harder to get a gun. But for those who have guns, she's not talking about taking away anyone's guns.
Let me see what Edward from Warminster has to say. Edward, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. One of the guest speakers at the convention stated that not using coal costs each household, I believe she said $15,000, which I was astonished. Is there any truth to that?
In fact, Eugene, that's something that you have fact-checked.
Yes, we did. No, there is no truth to that. She wasn't talking about just coal. She was talking about all regulations. And where she gets this number from is there's a then there's a lot of think tanks down in Washington that spin the facts here. And what they've done was they took data from that on regulations and how much they cost and then just divided that number by household in the United States. But that's just the cost number. That's not the benefit number. So, for example, if we're talking about regulations that deal with gas mileage, so these regulations may increase the cost of a car, but on the other end, you're spending less money in gas, and there's some health benefits as well. So, you know, the net impact is not $15,000 per household.
Edward, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. We are fact-checking some of the comments and speeches that have been said at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Also curious about whether you check fact checks, and there are a number of organizations like factcheck.org, and whether you find that stuff is useful. Eugene, we actually had a guest on the show, Ann Stone, who is a Trump supporter, and she said on our airwaves, and I didn't frankly have the information to fact check her live, which was that Hillary Clinton paid her staff less than what Donald Trump paid his staff. Can you fact check that for us?
Well, we did, actually, in today's story. The claim was made at the convention that Hillary Clinton, when she was a senator, paid her staffers, women staffers, less than men. This was based on the Washington Free Beacon article. Washington Free Beacon is a conservative publication. And what they did, and it was legitimate what they did, but they looked at publicly available expense reports that are submitted by the senator to the secretary of the Senate. However, you know, you look at this data different ways, because what we did was we got some data that was not just people who are working full time, but they're people who are working part time or people who are on leave of absences and the like. So what you see in there is expenses as opposed to salaries. So when you look at salaries based on people who are not just working full-time, but people who are working part-time or on a leave of absence, then you don't see that difference between men and women. Right. So there's two different ways of looking at that.
There was some searing there was a searing speech on Monday night, a woman describing her son Sean, who was killed in Benghazi.
Right.
and basically again saying that Hillary Clinton should be in jail, that she held her personally responsible for the death of her son. And I did a little reading on this because I just wanted to find out what was the context here, and I wonder, as someone who does fact checking, Eugene, how you get to that, knowing that this is obviously a very personal situation. These were comments or conversations that didn't happen in public but happened in private. Is there any way to fact check something like that?
We have not. The Washington Post fact checker has. And what he found, what he did and what you can do is he reached out to as many family members as he could that would talk to him and wrote a story that said, basically, we don't know what was said. Some of the family members said that she blamed it on the video. And this is the video, the anti-Muslim video that was circulating at the time on the internet and caused the protest in Egypt. And there were other family members who said she didn't bring that up at all. So that's what Patricia Smith is talking about. She says that Clinton told her that the reason why her son died was because of the video,
right,
and that turned out not to be the case. So, you know, looking, I was reluctant, frankly, to get into that because we can't render a decision on that. We weren't party to those conversations that they had. It was a very emotional time, obviously. It was done on, you know, the tarmac at the Andrews Air Force Base when the bodies were being transported. So, but that's yeah, how you can go about it, and basically it's going to be a very unsatisfying result.
In fact, a question from Kevin wanting to know how you decide what to fact check. There's so much information out there. How do you decide?
Well, we set parameters.
And that's Kevin, our engineer, I should say, just to give him full credit here. Go ahead, Eugene.
No, it's a good question. We set parameters on what we do. So, you know, what we're doing here during the convention is we're going through all the primetime speeches. And we'll do the same thing for the Democratic convention as well. We get the prepared remarks in advance. We'll read through those. We'll listen to them because sometimes they go off script, like Ben Carson did last night. So that's the way we do it during these nights. You know, same thing with debates, where we'll watch every single debate and we'll flag anything that we hear that can be checked as a fact. You know, there are going to be a lot of opinions espoused, especially at events like this. We don't fact check opinions, yeah. But when they start throwing out numbers like every household has a burden of $15,000 because of regulations, well, we can look at that and then ask the people who made those claims or the organizations that made those claims, where did that number come from?
So you can't fact check whether Hillary Clinton believes in Lucifer or not, which is something that Ben Carson said.
Right.
Okay, enough said, right?
Mm-hmm.
How about a lot of fact checkers have said that Donald Trump has really made them work overtime. And I don't know how much you keep score or not, but when you compare him, and it's probably too soon to compare Hillary Clinton at this point, but when you compare him over the last 13 months running for office, so many different candidates, what's your takeaway?
Well, he's unscripted. He's undisciplined, and he has a tendency to speak off the top of his head. He's not a politician, and he's proud of that. So those elements are going to cause more work for fact checkers. Where Hillary Clinton, who's been in the public eye since, what, the 1970s?
Something like that.
She knows what she's doing in terms of following a script and being disciplined and having her remarks vetted by staff. So with her, it's more, at least what we found, is spinning of facts, you know, not telling the whole story or cherry-picking data or using selective evidence, things like that, where with Donald Trump, and we do see that with Donald Trump as well when he's on script and he's speaking from a script, and he has done that more recently. But when he's off script, that's when he's saying things, frankly, off the top of his head, mm-hmm. and it creates a lot of work for us, yeah.
I'm sure it does. But is there any way to calculate who is more dishonest between those two?
Well, there are a lot of stories that we've done on both of them. I mean, if you go to our site, there's more than 100 on each one of them. And even within in those stories, there may be 2, 3, 4, 5 claims that they've made. So I haven't gone back and tallied them all up. I think there's plenty there for both sides to use against the other.
There'll be more coming tonight. How do you prepare? We're almost out of time here, but how do you prepare then for a convention night?
Well, we'll get the prepared remarks in advance. So once we get that, we can start going through that, split them up, and start to identify things, then listen to those speeches as they're being told. If there's an event that we have a theme to, like Make America Work Again, which was the theme of day two,
right.
I could start pulling out some information that we've already written on economy, jobs. So we know that there are certain talking points that they go to, both sides. So we could start doing some preparing.
Well, on that note, Eugene Colley, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Director of FactCheck.org. The final of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. You can check us out on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. You can talk to us in all sorts of different ways. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Madison Poulter helping us out this week as our summer intern. And Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.